Have you started recording?
Okay. No, I'm starting right now. Mm-hmm.
So here we are, Tom. So what is, you know, we were talking about the difference of the boundaries between, let's say, real life and performance at the moment.
Right.
They're all collapsing.
Yes.
So what are we doing now? Is this like a real conversation or is this a performance?
Well, I mean, according to Marlon Brando, it's both. And right. Marlon Brando is, of course, the ultimate arbiter.
As I noticed, when you press the record button, something changes in my spirit and I get into performance mode.
Right.
There's something that's a little bit awakened in me. I think, okay, maybe there's an audience there somewhere.
Well, no, we have an audience. I told you, 15,000 people per week, basically. Yeah. But
I thought it was more than that, Tom.
You think? I haven't looked at it.
Yeah, right.
No, but I mean, Brando said we're all acting, you know? And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, but when the recording button's not on, I'm acting a different way if we're just talking, you know, me and you. And now the recording button is on. We're imagining an audience hearing us.
Yeah.
When it changes the timbre and the tone and the intention and the.
Does it, Andrew?
You feel like you have to, like, you know, perform or, you know.
No, it's more censoring going on, no?
Self-censoring and also sort of like trying to be cool. And
yeah, well, but the thing is, you know, the better you know somebody, the easier it gets, you know, and the more the lines are blurring between, you know, just conversational chatting and the recording, you know?
Yes.
Because I don't have, with you, I don't have the feeling that our conversation changes too much. But I have some friends, you know, I have like the best conversations and it's like, oh, come on. You know, it's like, let's record that. And then I did. And it was horrendous because it's like, then the difference was too big between being self-conscious and just go with the flow, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in Montreal, we used to have all these cabarets. And what I liked about them was that people would perform and they would try things out.
Yeah,
they were done, and it was very spontaneous, and there was a big mixture of the sublime and the ridiculous and the horrible, and everything was kind of put on a stage.
Yeah,
and everybody was allowed to go on the stage, and there was this kind of creative, let's say, mixing of all kinds of people. But when people get on a stage and they want to do their thing, you know, they turn into something else. And I know, yeah, our conversations are more or less the same when the record button is on, but there's something in me that's just a little bit more awake.
Yes. And I don't think it's necessarily only that, you know, like a performance towards an audience. I think there's another aspect going on there, because at least for me, it's like I can have these conversations with you, you know, like we did like the 10, 15 minutes before. And it's just me like doing, just expressing myself, right?
Yeah.
But it's not that, it's not a discipline. And when I'm recording, it becomes a kind of a discipline in the sense that I know where my boundaries are, what I can still learn. And so what I like is like to listen to other podcasts and see how they do it, you know, to be more playful, to be more creative, to be more intuitive, yeah. and not to be that stiff German, but to be more like on purpose, more playful, like on purpose, more chaotic, you know, because it's like what Don Juan from Carlos Castaneda said, this controlled, how did he call it? Craziness.
Controlled chaos.
Controlled chaos, controlled craziness.
Right.
And so that's it's not only a performance for other people, but also like to find to learn the ability to dance on the blade, you know, where or you know, so you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And there's a flow to the conversation, but then also if you could say something like if I brought up a topic like anal probing.
Yeah.
That would change the timbre of the conversation. So you can throw things in that sort of turns stuff upside down.
Right.
And
because of the comedic effect, or what do you mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking of it just somehow conversations get very banal and boring, and there's some part of me that wants to just like put a banana peel, just, you know.
Right.
When it gets very banal, I want to change the, I want to, you know, so you can say something like, I know even Tony Robbins, what he would, you know, he was doing couples therapy, and they would be having a kind of ordinary conversation, and then he would bring up blowjobs, like he'd say, like, what do you know?
Right.
What do you think about having a blowjob right now? And the guy would be like, ooh.
Yeah, also because I think, again, we talked about this, it's like as soon as you are able to talk about God and philosophy and all these things, you also have to be able to be authentically dirty, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And profane.
You have to be profane. Yeah, that's a very good topic, actually. Why do we have to be profane?
Yeah, because it means we have a well-rounded personality, you know. You don't have taboos, or at least you're aware of your taboos, and you can play with them without being too self-conscious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, yeah. And so it also signifies that you have had some experiences. I mean, let's talk about anal probing and.
Yeah. Well, what is anal probing exactly?
Yeah, no, but you know what I'm saying.
Is it like a metaphor here that we're talking about? We're actually talking about a medical, intervention.
No, we're still talking about the extraterrestrials, you know, and the Fermi paradox. I think.
What?
The Fermi paradox.
You lost me there, Tom.
No, but again, it's like for me, the interesting thing is always, you know, to develop a well-rounded personality. You know, I'm reading this book of Niklas Taleb again, A Skin in the Game.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, he distinguishes between, you know, these people who have no skin in the game, you know, the politicians and, you know, the high stakes businessmen, you know, from, you know, the artists and the plumbers, you know, who always have skin in the game. And so
I think not having skin in the game means you're disembodied and you're monological.
Right. And so you need life experiences,
yeah,
to have skin in the game. But as soon as you have life experience, your personality develops and gets kind of more, as it gets bigger and more complex. And that translates into a different kind of language that you are able to use.
Yeah.
And so, I mean.
Yeah. So, and then you need the bitter and the sweet.
Right.
You need to be bittersweet. If you're just sweet, then it's, you know, it's kind of nauseating. And if you're just bitter and cynical, then it's up. So I think bittersweet is a good, I think a well-rounded personality has a bittersweet sense of life.
Yeah.
Or a tragicomic sense of life. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, we were talking before the recording about the interview Greg Henriques did with Layman Pascal.
Yeah.
Right? This well-being interview where Layman laid open his soul. Is it the expression, you know, bare yeah, open his soul?
Bare his soul, yeah.
And so that was like, my impression was this, at the same time, amazing and shocking, because I would be way more restrictive of what I'm wanted to share in that kind of public setting. But apart from that, it shows how versatile Layman is in self-observance and expressing what he's observing with himself. So that was kind of amazing, because you have to have life experience. You have to have skin in the game to be like that kind of precise and open about what's going on in your life in a public setting. And it's not just a performance for other people. It just shows, it also showed that he has the capacities to do that, because not everybody has. You get what I'm saying? And I'm going back to what you're saying about
should we bare our souls in the public? It's a good question. I mean, maybe he has that ability.
Yeah.
And to still, but he still has a bit of charm about his character that people like him, right?
Because, right.
You know, so there's a dance going on at the same time. It's not just, he's not just giving you a list of his, you know, strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
he's able to paint a picture, tell a story, right? There's still a narrative going on there. It's not just bare everything, you know. I would imagine. I haven't listened to the podcast, so.
You know, but the interesting thing is, in terms of, you know, Johnny Depp and Layman Pascal, it's like, okay, so what is true? You know, what is performance? You know, that I find the question that you're raising very interesting, mm-hmm. because I would like, what I like, for example, like when I'm reading an artist, Henry Miller, let's say, I'm reading a book of Henry Miller, or mm-hmm. like some of those guys, and then I get a tidbit from the internet or from other books, like an anecdote about who they were in reality.
Yeah.
I find that super interesting. I mean, that is something that excites me to learn about the true life of.
Yeah.
Because like,
I remember somebody interviewing Henry Miller and saying, what did the hell did you write there? Because he's supposed to be doing biography. Like all of his writing was about his own life.
Right.
More or less. And then these poetic extrapolations. And long, you know, beautiful, you know, dirty prose. But somebody asked him, was like, why did you write that? That was obviously a lie because it wasn't factually true what he was saying, you know? And he said, well, you know, it's a bit like Rabelais, right? It's like, I guess that I get away with it because there's something more true than just the surface narrative.
Right.
So I guess he was like, if he was just lying, if there was just a, you know, a bare lie, he'd be evading something. But he's actually trying. He's actually doing hyper truth or compressed truth or
right.
So even though it's supposed to be biography romance or something.
Yeah, autofiction, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Autofiction. It's still a performance. It's still fake. It's in some way. It's still choosing some information and leaving out others. And so there is no real biography. There can never be because of the complexity of the human
being. Right, right.
There's just a choice between a lot of narratives, you know.
Past. Yeah, well, that's the postmodern insight, isn't it? You know?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That's a postmodern insight. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's not quite the postmodern insight because there is still a vérité. There is still a truth. There's still a pattern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which makes something true. So you can't fully deconstruct the person. And there's still a person there, right? That you can kind of.
Yeah, no, but, you know, going back to that, you know, performance, because, you know, there is a postmodern definition of performance. Mm. And then there is like a postmodern or metamodern or performatist approach to performatism. And those two things mean different things, you know, these two interpretations. And, you know, one is, okay, there is no narrative and there are just narratives within narratives. There is no, you know, it's all relative. And then there's like the metamodern or postmodern approach that says something like, okay, we enact some narratives as if they were true. And we, you know, we act accordingly, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of being lost in the myriads of narratives, we arbitrarily choose one and live a life like this.
Yeah. How arbitrary, though? I mean, is the question.
I mean, yeah.
There's a pattern. There's a pattern.
No, but going back to Layman, because let's assume he's postmodern or metamodern or whatever. So he doesn't, he is honest about himself, but it's also a performance, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is, because,
yeah, exactly.
And I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean, just what it is.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So there's the persona.
Right.
Okay. And then there's the quote unquote real person. And so I guess what you could say that Layman and the persona have sort of, you know, become transparent. The persona is transparent in Layman's case, maybe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Rather than there being a big split there, because I guess mental illness is when there's a big split between the persona and whatever's really going on in the unconscious mind.
Yeah.
The person is totally split. Right. So I guess if we're looking at Johnny Depp, okay, is that Johnny Depp? Or is there a big split there?
Right.
Between who he really is and what he's able to express, yeah. On trial or.
That is so interesting.
Obviously, with Amber, there's an extreme schizophrenic split, I think, because I think it feels to me obvious that Amber Heard has this sort of double personality, like two, you know.
Yeah.
That is a bit psychotic. Well, I'm not sure about him.
Yeah, I think they're both not very healthy, actually.
Well, they're both not, you know, but he seems a little bit more like
centered.
Like that the performance and the person are more aligned.
Yeah. So this morning when I was having my coffee, I was like going through Twitter and there was one study and that says that the Gen Z people, young folks, mm-hmm. right, that they, you know, have sex in a similar amount to people over 75 in average. So they have barely sex or very seldomly. So the under 25-year-old people. But at the same time, as like if you go to the millennials or Gen X, they have way more sex. But the Gen Z, when is it, like 19, born after 1990? Mm-hmm. They have barely sex. And at the same time, they're preoccupied with gender and all that stuff. You know, cake gender, what that's the news thing. You know, I'm feeling like cake gender, whatever. But the argument, let me just finish that. The argument was here that maybe they are so preoccupied with gender expression and all of this because they actually have no sex. And that was the argument here, that there's a disconnect between the real person and what they're like signaling to the outside. And so that was similar with what I was talking with Owen, so that all the young guys are so preoccupied with, let's say, porn and eating ass and whatever, without actually having real life experiences about this. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a big gap between their persona and
the self, or what we could call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the schizophrenic split. Yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so on one hand, well, they have to sort of create a fantasy persona.
Right.
Which compensates for something. For the lack of the real in their lives.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, sure. It makes sense to me.
No, I mean, like, again, relating this to Layman, because, I mean, we can talk about this because he talked about this openly. He said he has, like, sex more or less every day when I correct myself. And mm-hmm. so he also, you know, and so, but he's a different generation. And there's an overlap between self and persona and performance and truth. And that all lines up perfectly. And that is what's so interesting and shocking at that video, for me at least. Mm-hmm. But that's not the, you know, normal state of people being out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I'm 51, so that makes me Generation X. And like in the 90s, there's lots of sex going on. I mean,
yeah.
It seemed to me anyway. And there wasn't much control of it wasn't much parental control and it yeah. wasn't necessarily much porn either, but everything was quite libertine in the 90s.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the internet came on, then there's these new protocols of behavior.
Yeah.
Which come into the play. And then people get very confused, and that's where we are now is people trying to figure out the protocols of behavior with this new technology and figure out their fantasy world and then how it corresponds with their real world. That's what I hear from them. That's usually it's like, okay, yeah. I've got these wild, violent, you know, fantasies. And then I love my girlfriend so much, but there's a gap here, you know, there's a huge gap. I don't know how to bring those two things together.
Mm.
it's the schizoid nature of the culture right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's Christianity, isn't it? Because I was thinking about this, you know. I mean, like, I think
in Protestant... Why is it Christianity?
No, well, it's Protestantism, you know. It's like the self-regulation and the pushing away of the dark impulses and the sexual impulses, the violent impulses, and with the effect that, you know, you can organize large amounts of people on one side, you know, over religion or whatever. On the other side, by making everybody equally unhappy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and this is because that is what identity politics is for. It's like it's you know, organizing of people, but at the same time, it's hugely repressive.
Well, it's both. It's sex positive and sex negative at the same time.
That's exactly.
Super sex positive, but then nobody's, you know, enjoying themselves.
Exactly.
And then there's this. Well, I guess it's been sex repressive for a long time, and then it swings over to plus. So it goes from plus to minus to plus to minus to plus to minus, but it's still not a sophisticated erotic, you know, view of life.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's why I like the philosophy of the libertines so much, you know, because they you know, just to try to get rid of these strange value systems and to just, you know, this Christian value system and just to experience life, to have skin in the game and to do stuff and to develop a well-rounded personality.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the Jewish culture and in other cultures, people have a pretty relaxed view of sex.
Yeah.
It's just a relaxed view. It's just like, it's not such a big deal.
Hmm.
Of course, sex is a big deal, but I guess in the West, because there's these extremes, I guess on the one hand, this neo-traditionalism coming back and Jordan Peterson. And,
interesting, know, that you say that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Coming back, and then on the other hand, wild pagan experimentalism and stuff. So it's just
so positive. What did you think about the Jordan Peterson thing last week?
I'm not very interested in, like, it's just, it, well, on one hand, it's like, well, I think his sort of persona in the culture is getting very boring. So I think, okay, here's another Jordan Peterson thing. Who cares? You know?
No, I mean, in context of what we're talking about.
That was my reaction. And then in a way, what he was saying, I was like somewhat sympathetic. It's like, okay, you're trying to promote what, obesity in the culture and trying to make it beautiful or what? On the other hand, there are women, different body types of women, and somebody could find that lady very, very attractive, and, you know, in another context. And so it was just something he said that people make a big deal about. And you know, who cares? That was my reaction.
Right.
But I think probably he's right to get off Twitter. Just get off Twitter. If you have to, every time you have to go on Twitter, you have to do some... explode, there has to be some big explosive drama, then probably being on Twitter is not a very good place to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we're talking still about performance and, you know, the gap, the, how did you call it, the schizoid state,
the schizoid state of the culture, I think.
Yeah. And so, because what was clear from the beginning with Jordan Peterson was that there's a part of his personality that seems not very well developed. And this is his sexuality. You know, he's all with logos, mm-hmm. but, you know, you can't really imagine,
yeah, right.
You can't really imagine Jordan Peterson being in an orgy on fucking two women and three guys, you know? It's like, he's not there. So his,
he's with the same woman he's been since he's 14. He promotes that. He promotes, like,
no, and he has not a very masculine voice. I mean, he's very, I don't want to talk bad about him, but I'm just noticing that there's a part of his personality apparently not that well developed, right?
Perhaps.
And so, and then he's confronted with an image. And he could have just said, oh no, well, why do you want to promote obesity here? That would be like a rational expression of what he's talking about. But he got emotional and he said, oh no, that's not beautiful. And so that was his not developed.
Well, it might be beautiful for somebody.
No, it is. No, obviously.
Well, so saying that's not objectively beautiful, it's kind of like a shitty science, you know, scientism, I think.
Yeah, that was...
You have the measurements and you can say, this is beautiful because you've done all these psychological tests about what men think is beautiful on average and da-da-da-da-da.
No, because he never was in that state of horniness, in that state where he find that kind of woman attractive. I know that place.
Yes, okay, I got you, yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so I can see that there is a beauty standard in our society, and that society tries to change that, and you have the whole discussion about obesity, blah 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 blah. But you know,
yeah, that's good.
To be the other side of that is I can find the place where I find that kind of woman in certain situations extremely sexy.
And yeah, beautiful. I agree with you there. I definitely agree with you there. Yeah, I mean, she yeah, she's just big, you know.
It's to fuck the shit out of her, you know.
Substantial woman, substantial woman. Yes. There so and, yeah, okay.
And then when you open yourself up to a woman, and I never had that I found that the closer I got to her, that I thought, oh, that's an ugly woman. Quite the opposite. That the closer I got to her, the more I had the impression, oh, that's a very beautiful woman.
Yeah.
You know. And so, but in this absolutist way to say, that's not beautiful, that says something about him way more than it says about anything else.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I mean, I think he's waging a war against woke. And that's, you know, where you can't even, you know, you can't even have a model of beauty, right? Because everybody's beautiful, which is bullshit.
Yeah.
Everybody is beautiful, right?
No.
There is something true about that. It's like, okay, the war against this kind of like, so if you're not that beautiful physically, you could have other qualities. You know, not everybody has to be beautiful physically. So I get that critique. And who cares? I mean, beauty just comes and goes. It's flowers and then it's gone. You have to have a character. But yeah, I think it was just a sort of impulsive thing that he said, and then
I get that. But it's
at the end of his Twitter thing, like it's the kind of thing you would say at a bar. And I don't know, maybe does it say that he's sexually repressed? Yeah, maybe he hasn't explored areas of sexuality.
No, just if you look at this kind of way how he was phrasing it, I know it was just a. Maybe it's the spur of the moment kind of thing, but at the same time, it's interesting because we're talking about, you know, the schizophrenic condition, you know, and so and the well-rounded personality, and you can see in those you can see like lots of instances where you see that his insight into religion and psychology and spirituality is authentic.
We're
not talking about this.
But
we also can also like highlight the instances where you see like in Wilberian terms, his line of sexual line of development, you know, is not very well developed. That's what it is. And you can hear that from his voice, basically.
From the way he speaks. Okay, maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
And because like
he tends to attract men more than women also, which is interesting.
Yeah, like meek men, no?
What? Meek. Well, guys who are sort of lost and they're looking for something and want to get their life together, and they go, "Oh, wow, Jordan Peterson, religion." I don't want to denigrate that because
no, it's not about denigrating anything. It's just observing.
I think that because I think that he has a lot of really great qualities. I don't want
to, sure.
But again, I mean, we all have our weaknesses, but the problem is that he's in the limelight, and he's like, you know, everything he does is scrutinized, and also he tends to want to provoke. So maybe that's an impulsive male thing that has something to do with the sexuality not being integrated. It's like you have to provoke each time.
But you know what, Andrew? I think that argument is correct, but there's something missing. And I think he, because it's sublimation in Freudian terms, he thinks he wants to provoke something in culture, but in reality, he wants to provoke something within himself. Exact what is missing, the lack of, you know, the sexual persona, let's say. Because like, if you compare him with Henry Miller had a sexual persona.
Yeah.
It was integrated.
Yeah.
And because when you do something like that, you always want to provoke something within yourself to come out to, because it wants to be integrated.
That's a very interesting discussion. Yeah, because a lot of intellectuals don't have a sexual persona, do they?
They're
just intellectuals, so they think all the time, and they kind of move away from the world and live in books.
Right.
You know, and so they do that for a reason. It's like being a monk. You can't be confronting the feminine all the time and keep a focus.
Right.
You know, so there is a way in which there is some monastic thing that has to happen in order for a person to become a thinker.
Right.
Because, you know, Peterson, at one point he decided not to drink anymore.
Right.
And then just study and then, you know, write his book. And so he was just laser focused on that. And you don't develop a sexual persona. That's the problem. You know, there is an alchemical, you could describe that in alchemical terms. You know, if you look at the inner tantras, you have the white drop and the red drop. And when the white drop up here, it's the mental gets crystallized and frozen, then it loses connection to the red drop down here, which is the feminine, which is the fire that releases up. So they end up being very separate.
Yeah, Taleb talks about this. You know, he uses this.
I think that's often the problem with intellectuals. The Achilles heel of intellectuals is they can't enter real life. They can't enter real sexuality. They can't do the body, and then you know, even if they want to. So Jordan Peterson is very sort of
dogmatic
about marriage and all that, because that's a way of containing and controlling and sexuality, and it's not dangerous and it's safe, and it's what we would say in Buddhism, it's sutric. Peterson is a good sutric. We talk sometimes about sutra and tantra. He's a good sutric teacher. He's a good teacher of ethics and morality and behavior. But then that gets dry and boring and uninteresting after a while.
Yes, I think that's also what you're saying, Taleb's argument and skin in the game, because he uses the example of the professor. As somebody who has not skin in the game, because the only thing you learn while getting to be a professor is to be a professor, like a bookworm or what, but you know, it's like,
yeah,
that's not the idea of skin in the game.
Yeah. I mean, to defend Peterson, he doesn't just remain in the ivory tower, and he wants to get out there and affect the culture and he's a psychologist, so he works with, I think there has to be, let's say, if you want to become an intellectual or if you want to become, there is a point where, okay, in your 20s or when you're young, there's this, you know, the sexuality is so powerful. It's like a wild horse you can't control. And that can kill you at a certain point almost, right? And then you have to, let's say, become a serious person. Uh-huh. So then you have to study, and then you have to kind of separate from that a little bit and get your, but then I think later on when things get interesting, you have to come back to it. You know, I'm thinking about, if you think about Picasso or you know, the French painters, and they were profoundly sensual, you know, sexual people in their later life. Not because they were fucking all the time or anything, but the, it's not about performance, but it's about the sensuality of existence, you know. So rather than being just uptight Protestant forever, you know.
Andrew, that's my problem with, you know, basically all of the liminal web, because it sometimes I just think, what is it for? You know, mm-hmm. you talk about Wilbur and you talk about metamodernism, and then you talk more about this, and then you talk more about this, and then you talk more about this, and then you would find another aspect, and somebody else is writing another book, and then you somebody have a podcast about that book, and some people talk about this, and then talk about this even more. And it was like, after years, it's like, okay, I'm fed up. Because like, where is, you know, where's the skin in the game? Where's the real life experiences? Where is, you know, the challenge of the dragon? Where is, you know, the art, you know, the life-changing art? Like, where's the fight that somebody is like having within the world?
If it stays up here, if it stays in the intellectual world, it just abstraction upon abstraction, and you know, castle in the sky, right?
Right.
It might be very, you know, fun and attractive when you get together and have events and things like this. But yeah, I think you're right. It's like, okay, how do you bring this down and, you know, into the guts?
And so that, you know, this is something that I'm missing. And going back to my argument, it says something also about myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's like we are projecting and sublimating all the time. And, you know, I can't say that has nothing to do with me. Obviously, I want to be more, you know, let's say fighting the dragon in the real world, you know, and I'm struggling with this because I'm so, you know, but again, the diagnosis is nonetheless still true.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And maybe it's also the nature of the internet.
Yeah.
As well, what the internet does, and the internet tends to make favor abstraction.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I guess we're not creating cubist or impressionist painters very much. We're creating more and more theoreticians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People with all kinds of theories.
Yeah, but if you don't, you know, there's like this German science theorist, Wolfgang Balzer, and he says, you know, he has like developed in the 90s a meta theory, how to evaluate the useful, the truth and the validity of a scientific theory, right? And or like any theory. And that's a mechanism he can lay over like a theory and then deduct. And so his thing is that he says that, I hope I get this right, a theory is more, the more truth, the more you can apply it to the real life. And so if you have like a theory like, and he uses explicitly Freud, there are no ways, the amount of applications is actually very, 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 very slim and low.
Yeah, the application of Freudian theory to real life is low. Mm-hmm.
So, and that says something about the theory, you know, because then you have like other theories, let's say like a theory of physics or whatever, and then you have the real life applications. And so the status of that theory is kind of different. And so he says you have to evaluate a theory in terms of its applications, its possible applications. And so if a theory like metamodernism and or integral theory is, if the only application is that we have that we can color code everything.
Yeah.
But we're not leaving actually the realm of discourse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess we have to go beyond discourse. I mean, I wouldn't say that Freudian theory it doesn't have application. I think it's been applied like crazy in advertising and, I think it's, but it maybe not directly applicable. So there is a meta theory that affects other things. Like, we don't want to throw that in the garbage completely and just be utilitarian. But I see what you're saying.
I don't know. Balzer, he's a famous German, what is the word? Like a scientist, like a theorist of science, like somebody who values scientific modeling and scientific paradigms and stuff like this. So it's a very interesting approach. Anyhow, but we're diverging, we're still talking about, the gap between persona and what you're like, kind of, and yourself, let's say, that you try to find way to get the best overlap.
Yeah.
And to find an authenticity in your life.
Yeah. Well, we were looking at Wagner's Parsifal the other day, and, Parsifal is like the fool. And so we need more of the fool to break apart these theoretical structures.
Yeah.
The fool plays a very important role somehow, because otherwise people get very serious and they get stuck. And, you have the king in the Grail Castle, right? And he has everything, but he's sick, right? And he can't experience it. So there's beautiful feasts all around him. There's all this stuff going on, and he can't really experience it because that's modern man, right? He's sort of stuck in this. The thing that wakes him up is the crazy fool, who comes in and wakes him out of his wounded condition of impotence. Where he can't really rule the kingdom, and then the kingdom is sick, and everything is
right.
Yeah. I don't know where I was going with that, but
I know where you're going with it.
All of this hyper theoretical stuff, and then how does it relate to the real and whatever? It's like so the fool has to come in and like all the table is set and everybody, and he has to just like clear the table.
Well, it's also a state of being, If you just look at Rogan. Because what makes him so successful with, his 2000 interviews that he did or whatever, how much it is, he always plays the role of the, it's not the fool, but it's like very similar. But so he's like, he has always he's like this beginner's mind, and so he's completely embodied in
beginner's
that.
Mind, yeah, exactly.
And then you have this person who does like hunting and podcasting and comedy shows and television roles. And so he's completely embodied in the world. For him, it's not an intellectual exercise doing podcasts. For him, it's like a state of being and of having interest and engaging in an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. What is it about something that makes a person kind of relevant is another interesting question, And I think that maybe the answer is like he has to have one foot in chaos and one foot on the ground.
Yeah.
Because when somebody like Jordan Peterson becomes too reified in the culture, then it gets boring and it's like. Or somebody else gets. But the person who has like the person who can fall apart and come back together and is able to dance with all the different aspects of himself, maybe how you were describing Layman, in the podcast.
Yeah,
Layman has this sort of savior fool quality to his character, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's just like it's a dance, no? And I mean, to be accepted and to be relevant, for and in culture is one thing, but to have the
Tom, I lost you there for a bit.
Do you hear me now?
Oh, we're good. Go on.
To be accepted and relevant in culture is like one thing, but then to be authentic and that's another thing. And I was like, in terms of Layman, I was like thinking, okay, maybe that's the point where he should go mainstream. It's just you know, maybe he should just find a radio, like a proper radio station, you know, and do his thing there, you know, not just within our, you know, yeah, podcasting world, but in the real world, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. Except the real world is weird right now. It's full of ghosts. It's like, what is the real world anymore? Like, where could he go? Like, on, you know, on public radio? No, it's too woke. They won't have anybody.
Oh, well, but I mean, like, imagine him being in a setup like Howard Stern or something. He absolutely could do that.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, maybe Layman should be the next, should be kind of the. I mean, you're very fond of Joe Rogan. I'm not as fond of him as you are, but he could be like the Joe Rogan of all of these integral metamodernist people. You know, he could be the guy that's able to juggle the whole.
Yeah.
The guy that's able to keep all the balls going of all the different, in all the different worlds, but doesn't really, it doesn't belong to any of them. And still belongs to them, but doesn't become narrow in its way of
thinking. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I mean, like something like Sirius XX, or what's the channel called, you know, Sirius X, where Howard Stern has his, you know, I think it's a proper radio. So when you're in New York and you are in a cab, and then you can listen to that thing over the radio, you know.
Radio XX, sure.
And somebody who makes the step outside of our little ecosystem, and, you know, and he has the golden voice, you know, he.
Mm-hmm, perhaps.
Yeah. Anywho.
Well, I don't think that's how it works, though. I think if you look at like Allen Ginsberg or something, it's that you don't go and make it in the world. The world comes to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like he could go and apply for a job at Radio XXX. It's like if there's something really going on there, then the attention will come.
Yeah, well, that's also true. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's like, I don't think, I was thinking about this, like people who become cultural figures who are a little bit unusual and talented and all that sort of thing. It's often like, it's not even their intention, you know?
Mm.
They just have an authenticity, and then people come. The people who try to manage or manicure or you know, micromanage every little detail of their lives and their career, they tend to be fake and boring.
Yeah.
But the people who like Bob Dylan, he didn't ever care about being famous at all. He just stumbled into it.
Yeah.
You know, he was just doing something he loved, and he sort of stumbled into it. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. I had this discussion actually yesterday.
You can't be pleasing people. If you're trying to please people, then you're in trouble.
Yeah. I had this discussion actually yesterday with a friend of mine who's a painter here in Palma. And so so the idea that, you know, how old is our civilization? Let's say 20,000 years at best, you know? And we still don't know what art is and why we do it, or what love is, you know, the constants of existence, you know. And so we're trying to do art, and we theorize about art, but, you know, what is it that, like, people like Almodovar, like the Spanish filmmaker you just mentioned, like Bob Dylan, they just pop and they're like complete, you know, and they in lots of cases they don't want to, but society wants them to, and it's as if it has to be there. It's a call from the future that, imagine a world without Picasso or Almodovar. Like, it would be like a world which is, you know, empty of something. There's something missing, and it seems
as you say, it's a call to the future, which means like the artist is the person who can see, who sort of sees beyond the horizon in some uncanny way.
Yeah.
So that is where like prophecy and art come together, and so you never listen to people who are, you should never listen to politicians or
right.
Social commentators or any of those people.
Yeah.
The people you always listen to are the serious artists. Like, I'm not that good at rap, but I think who's this rapper that has a new album out? He seems very interesting. The guy who won the Nobel Prize, what's his name?
Who?
Who's the guy who won the Nobel Prize for rap? Not the Nobel Prize, the literary prize for rap.
Jay-Z? I don't know.
No. He has a new album out.
For rap? I don't know.
For rap music. I'll tell you in a moment. Just a second. He seems to be, I was just looking at a couple of his songs. Yeah, it's called Mr. Morale and the Big Stepper. Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. He has a new album out. I haven't heard that yet.
Mm-hmm. And it's good. I was listening to it and I was like, okay, this guy is like, okay, this is somebody to listen to.
Right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Something about him that is prophetic. I don't know what it is because I don't know the rap genre enough, but I can feel that there's something about this guy that.
Yeah.
You'd have to talk to some of our friends like Cadell to say why, or because they know rap better than me. But you know this.
Yeah, the last album was amazing, To Pimp a Butterfly or whatever that's called. Yes.
No, he had one after that, the one that the prize that wasn't that good, but To Pimp a Butterfly was good. But this one sounds very interesting to me.
Okay.
Even though I'm pretty useless when it comes to rap.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. You know, so what, you know. What is it that, why is it that some people can create a piece of art and it's complete and enriches culture? Because it's like, you know, you have the idea that you live in the suburbs of Seattle and there are like 2,000 families and 2,000 boys who are like exactly in the same environment.
And one person comes out.
And then one person, he's called Kurt, you know?
Yeah.
And so he just changes the whole way how we did music in the 90s.
But the interesting thing is, one thing I've understood, I think, is that they always come from, like the great artists come from the province, they come from the faraway place. They come from, like Rimbaud came from like some little town, and you know, he didn't come from Paris. You
know? Yeah.
And then he made it in Paris, but they come from the desert, like, The prophets come from the desert, you know, the great artists.
Yeah, but why Kurt and not his friend Michael?
Like Seattle is like the desert, right? I mean, who, you know, why Kurt and not his friend Michael? I don't know, because Kurt had a powerful voice, I guess, and he was kind of otherworldly.
Yeah, no, yeah, but again, I still think that we still don't know what's going on. You know, we have theories and approaches, and we only
describe it in retrospect because everything happens. But
yeah,
then we say, oh, it happened because he's like this and this and this. But
yeah,
you know, but we often have a retrospect. We often see everything through a rearview mirror, as Marshall Gordon would say. We can't really see the future, and only the artist can see the future.
All right, Andrew, I think we got it.
Cool.